Everybody is a creator. The power of the internet allows people to be a creator and to find an audience. And for the ones who put the time in and the effort and are talented, they can build a life.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. Gigi Gorgeous, Shib Sibs, Joey Graceffa, or simply Liza. If you don't know who these millionaire video stars are, ask almost any teenager. Over the past 10 years, the creator economy fostered by YouTube and other platforms like Twitch have exploded with talent and fans. The focal point of this next generation of entertainment information is VidCon, founded and headquartered in Missoula, Montana. This June, VidCon had more than 74,000 attendees at its 9th annual conference. Today on Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, we are joined by VidCon CEO Jim Lauterbach. Jim is a tech veteran and former editor of PC Magazine, who will share an insider's view on how the video industry is shaping our entertainment future. Production support for this Can Do podcast is made possible in part by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Support for this Montana Public Radio podcast comes from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks.
Is there a tidal wave of new entertainment and information content happening while most of us haven't been paying attention?
Well, yes, there has been.
And what is that? Can you explain to our listeners what this creator economy is and how it works?
Yeah, so in the traditional days of television or radio or celebrity entertainment, you kind of had to be made by the gatekeepers. There were these gatekeepers, whether it's in Hollywood or New York or other places. If they liked you, they'd do a pilot with you, they'd give you a try, they'd promote you. And traditional celebrities were built up through this, I think Joni Mitchell called it the star-making machinery, right? Well, this generation of democratized media is created, discovered, and built by the fans and the communities themselves. So the big stars that we know from television and movies and things like that, they all went through that star-making machinery. The big stars in online video, say YouTube or other places, Liza Koshy, for example, this is one of the biggest stars out there. She's a footprint of 45 million followers, viewers, subscribers, whatever, across all these different platforms. She started out, the day she started out, had zero.
So how'd that happen?
She built her audience one by one, two by two, three by three on YouTube, for example, by creating video, putting it out there, and having it being discovered by people who liked it, who then shared it and told their friends, and they came in and they liked it and they subscribed so they could watch the next one and the next one. It's a lot of hard work, a lot of sweat, a little bit of luck. But it's very different from the way the traditional, say, movie stars and others were created, built, packaged, and sold.
So you have commercial TV. Number one show on commercial TV is Big Bang Theory. It has been for a number of years. The video entertainers like Liza have much bigger audiences than those shows are attracting.
Absolutely. And they have, think about 48, 49 million followers, subscribers, et cetera, for Liza. We're going to Australia to do VidCon Australia, the big event that, the multiple events now that we do that's founded here in Montana. And we're bringing in Liza Koshy and Baby Ariel, who also has in the 40 million range across YouTube and Musical.ly and others. And I was looking, I said, you know what? Each of these has almost double the number of followers, subscribers, viewers, fans as the entire population of Australia.
You know, that's amazing. What did YouTube know or figure out that other media platforms didn't?
Well, I think with YouTube, it was about discovery and community and sharing. And it allowed you to subscribe to the people that you liked and then go see them. So YouTube And there were a number of services that came out around when YouTube did. There were many, many out there. And in many ways, YouTube got it right for the user experience. Because these days, you can't separate the content from the user experience. The two together are bound together in creating these media properties. So they built a great user experience, great way to discover stuff, great way to grow your audience. And the other thing that they did is they shared money with the creators. So if you went on YouTube and built a channel and built fans and community and they ran advertising, they gave you some of it. And that is still almost unique across all of these online video, social video services. YouTube shares the revenue.
So is this unsettling to the mainstream media way they've been doing things for, you know, 60 years?
Oh, absolutely. It's totally not destroying, but it's changing their business. Think about what happened with traditional media, all media. The history of the internet is the history of it changing media. And it started with the media that required the least amount of bandwidth, the least amount of bits. You know, remember those dial-up modems? We had dial-up modems. Newspapers got totally changed. And magazines, because letters are really easy to put through the internet. So that's why when we look at magazines, like Condé Nast is selling three of their top magazines, and they lost $120 million or something like that last quarter or last year. I don't know. The magazine industry has been decimated and totally changed because the early days of the internet, in the mid-90s, it was so easy to just get your news and your stories via that dial-up modem. Now, as bandwidth got better, you remember DSL and sort of faster internet?
Sure.
Not that fast. Now we'd look at it and be like, oh my gosh, that's so slow. But suddenly, you could download an entire album, music, in a couple minutes. So the entire music industry got totally changed by the internet. Podcasting, for example. I mean, some people think podcasting, what we're doing now, is a new medium. No. In the late 90s, there were services like Real Audio and others where we could do audio programs like this and distribute them via the internet. Thus, radio and music all transformed, all destroyed, and now rebuilt. Think about how the music industry has rebuilt itself with Spotify and other music services. And then what happened in the 2000s? Suddenly we had cable modems, and we had faster internet coming into the home. And now you could send video over these internet connections going to the home. And once you could do that, all of the moving picture businesses have been or are in the latter stages of being disrupted. So the path we saw with print, the path we saw with music and radio, is now the path that we're seeing with television and movies. And it's totally being disrupted because the power is in the hands of the users and the power is in the hands of the community. And they can go out and seek out what they want and grab it and watch it when they want to, rather than on somebody's schedule.
As you mentioned, they, as disruptors, this new platform that's getting so much traction must really be disturbing in a way, because they're built on advertisers and advertising. And if I'm an advertiser looking at where I want to spend my money and I take a look at how many views, you know, Liza has or Gigi Gorgeous or whatever, it has to be being discussed in the top echelons of companies what to do about this.
Well, there are a number of things happening in the world of advertising. Part of it is, how do you reach a really mass scale audience? Just because Liza Koshy has 47 million followers across all these services doesn't mean that when she posts something, 47 million people watch it. In aggregate, over the course of a month or two, that many people may come see what she does. A core group will watch everything she does. It could be in the tens and 20 millions, which is still huge, let's face it. But for mass scale, television still owns the sort of the prize of, like, the Super Bowl. Why is the Super Bowl become such a big deal? Because there is no other place where, is it 50 or 100? I don't know how many it is. But that many people are all watching the same thing at the same time. So if you're launching a new car or a new breakfast burrito, it is the best place to do that. Now, you can also go out to all the, you know, you bring together a group of these creators and launch a breakfast burrito too. But you're not going to do it with a 30-second spot. You can, and it works, and it's okay. But a much better way to do it is to go to Liza and Gigi Gorgeous and Hank and John Green, and give them money to eat your new breakfast burrito and talk about how wonderful it is. The problem with that is, though, it's very effective. The reason why it's effective is because I guarantee you those three probably will not eat that breakfast burrito, because if they don't believe in the product, they're not going to take your money to endorse it. And that's very different, because it means that as an advertiser, you can't just bound into these communities that these online video creators have created and spray your advertising message around and then leave. What you need to do is you need to create a relationship with the creator and their community, a long-term relationship. It's like you're not just going to come in and have a one-night stand. You got to get committed. You got to give that community something that it doesn't have. You've got to, the creator has to believe in it, and it has to be real. One of the words we use in online video all the time is authentic, to the point that it's been totally overused, and I hate to say it now, but it's true. If it's not authentic to the morals and the values and the desires of the creator, the audience is going to understand and get it anyway, because, like, let's face it, this is for millennials and Gen X people, it's the 30s and Gen Zs and in their teens and 20s, they can spot a fake a mile away. They're going to know when someone's faking it. And so you don't do that. Now, the other thing in advertising that I think is really interesting, and this is a little bit out of the online video space, but with data and Facebook and the fact that we have so much information about everybody on the internet, everybody who touches anything, if I'm a brand or a marketer, I can go out and build through that data a database of the people, my prospects, the people I want to sell to. And in many ways, I can bypass media altogether, because media, what was media? Media was just a way to aggregate an audience and a proxy for the audience you want to reach. The reason why you put something in the Big Bang Theory is because the people that watched it were an amalgamation mostly of the people you wanted to reach with your ad for your breakfast burrito. Well, I can go on the internet right now and find all the people that like breakfast burritos and convince them that they should come eat my burrito. I don't need media.
You mentioned Hank and John Green. So they were the founders or the visionaries that put VidCon together. So I want to talk about VidCon for a minute. You're the executive director. In 2010, you had 1,500 attendees. And here we go in 2018 in June, you had 74,000, you know, people coming through the gates. Talk about VidCon. What is it?
So VidCon started out as a celebration of this new world of online video. So in 2010, not a lot of people were watching YouTube. I mean, there was a lot of people watching it, but not a lot compared to now. These new creators were just starting to build their communities. So Hank and John, Hank Green moved here, and his now wife, they moved here in part because of the University of Montana. And his brother, you know, they grew up together. His brother was living in Indiana, and they started communicating with each other, as brothers do, rather than on the phone or otherwise, by making videos. So Hank would post a video on YouTube for John, and then John would watch it and post a video in response to Hank. So this private dialogue that siblings might have was a very public thing. And suddenly they became, you know, YouTube stars. People loved it. They watch it because they're intelligent and fun and witty and all that stuff. And so that channel, the Vlog Brothers, grew up and was one of the top channels on YouTube. And at some point, you know, in 2009, Hank was like, we need an event around this. We want to bring our fans together face-to-face, meet space, as we call it, you know, in the real time, not just virtual. So, and there were a bunch of other creators that had been building stuff and doing the same thing. And so they were like, you know, let's do this thing called VidCon. Let's get 40 or so of the top creators out there and bring them into this basement in Los Angeles. And let's have the fans come. And it's about 1,400 people came. And it was this celebration of this growing media, but also the connection that the fans had with the creators, but also with each other. So the early group of Hank and John's fans were called the Nerd Fighters and Nerd Fighteria. And it's still a thing, by the way. But the Nerd Fighters were a big part of the gathering. And they came and they had meetups and it was and they celebrated each other. And so you had maybe a couple hundred people who were fans of these guys who may have commented to each other and looked at each other and, you know, went back and forth, meeting for the first time face to face. And that was an incredibly powerful thing. And the fact is, a lot of people have said that the internet and all these internet and digital connectivity stuff will make face-to-face meetings go away. It's not true. It actually makes them more and more necessary, because sitting in your living room or your basement or your bedroom watching all these creators is great. As a creator, sitting in your bedroom making videos is great, but it's very isolating. We still have that need as humans to have this tribal experience of sharing things together in real time. And Hank and John tapped into that. And so VidCon started as that, you know, tribal fire that everybody sat around. And it continues to be that way. It's just as online video has grown, there are many more sort of different genres and niches and types of online video. The early stuff, Hank and John talking to each other and people like talking to the camera, vlogging, you know, a form of blogging, basically video blogging, was one of those early formats. And VidCon was pretty much all that, a little bit of music. A lot of Harry Potter fandom too, interestingly, that had those the roots of Harry Potter fandom. But now you've got all sorts of different genres inside online video. It's one reason why VidCon has grown from 1,400 to 74,000, is because now we celebrate gaming and beauty and celebrity pets and pranks and music and sports and food. And I could go on and on, but all those things have gathered great audiences around them.
You mentioned going to Australia. So is this a global phenomenon?
Yeah. Last year, we launched our first two out of the U.S. events. So we did one in Europe and one in Australia. This year already, we've done another one in Europe, and we will be doing Australia over Labor Day weekend. So everybody who's listening, you still have time. Hop on a plane. Come to Melbourne, Australia. Join us there. It'll be fun. And then next year, we'll do London and Australia again. And, you know, we will probably do more around the world because – just because, you know, we're a Montana-based company and VidCon is huge and it's mostly a U.S.-based event. But this year we had attendees from 51 states, Colombia I'm counting, and 70 countries. But this democratization of the creative economy and these great creators are all over the world. And, you know, you go to Brazil, it's an amazing group of authentic, wonderful creators who built huge communities around themselves, Portuguese language. Entirely different from what we see in the U.S. We go to Australia. Some of it's like what's in the U.S., but some of it's entirely different. And that's the story all around the world. And everywhere that is happening, we want a VidCon to happen too.
You mentioned the mainstream media, you know, being caught off guard and disrupted by this. But one mainstream media company was really smart, Viacom. And Viacom bought VidCon. And so what does that mean, and what has that experience been like?
Well, so Viacom, big media company, has been, since its founding, really at the roots of youth culture. So we're talking MTV and Nickelodeon and Comedy Central and BET, CWT. So these are some of their core brands. You know, when MTV came out in the, I think, August 80s. 1st was its, I think it's like, yeah, it may have been 1980 or 81, but it captured youth culture. And as youth culture has changed, as the media that they consume has changed, Viacom has changed as well. So something Viacom has been doing recently, which I think is super smart, is thinking about how do we reach audiences in everything from television to the left to experiential face-to-face, the sort of stuff I was talking about, the virtual or the real campfire on the right. And if we want to reach teens, we can't just continue to do TV and think we're going to be successful. Some of them will watch TV. Some of them will watch internet. Some of them will be on websites. And many of them will go to events. So let's build this connection with this key audience in all the places that they are and all the media types that we can do. So MTV has had the MTV Music Awards for a long time. They have the music, they have the movie awards. Nickelodeon has been doing the Slime Fest, which, by the way, go to the Slime Fest sometime. Slime is a thing, particularly if you're 10 or 11. BET has the BET Experience. Comedy Central is doing this amazing festival called Clusterfest in San Francisco, where they bring some of the top stand-up comedians and other people, and it's great. It's 3 days. It's awesome. And so there's a part of – another smart thing that Viacom did is they started something called the Viacom Digital Studio, which is creating video for online, video for TV, video for Netflix and other places. But they're doing it not to run on MTV or Nickelodeon. They're doing it to run on all these other new places. So it sits and straddles across all the brands and brings the brands out to these new destinations. They didn't have an event associated with them that could be Switzerland, that could be just unique to all these sites and all these services and all these platforms. And they bought us as VidCon to be part of that strategy of starting on the left of television and ending up on the right on experiential and face-to-face. And so we're a piece of that. So Viacom came and said, wow, you guys are great. You know youth culture. You own this. You have great connections to these creators that we need. You have great connections to this audience that our advertisers covet. If we buy you, 1 + 1 = 3 in many ways, where for advertisers, now we can tell them that we're reaching teens in this youth culture on all the places that they're going to, including face-to-face at VidCon.
I want to tell you one quick MTV story and the impact of a new channel or a new media vehicle. During the Russian transition from a command to demand economy, during Glasnost and Perestroika, they started letting Western programming on TV. And one of the first things that was on was MTV. And I happened to be in Moscow when they aired the first, show on Russian television. And the first act that they ever showed was Madonna. She was in her prime, it was late 80s. And she was doing one of her videos, and she had sort of pink hair at the time or whatever. Within 2 days in Moscow, every woman under the age of 50 was dressed like Madonna, and the whole country must have watched it because it was a changing event. I mean, it really was sort of a life-changing event for most Russians. But everybody walking around Moscow, you would have thought you were in a Madonna TV video.
Now, I want to be the one that had the pink hair dye when that happened.
Yeah, you would have been big. It would have been big. So let's talk about you for a minute. How did you get to the top of the industry? What's your pathway here?
It's relatively random. I mean, mostly I just like to do fun things. So I got a math degree at the University of Vermont, very similar to the University of Montana, actually, other side of the country, and got an MBA and I built computer systems early on. Started writing about what I was doing. We were doing some pretty innovative stuff back when the PCs were new, if you can believe that. I answered an ad in the New York Times to go run reviews at this computer magazine that talked to businesses called PC Week at this company, Ziff Davis. Never thought they'd give me the job, but maybe I'd write for them someday. But they hired me. So I went from doing consulting for five or so companies that were paying a lot of money to the consulting company that I was working for to go to a magazine where we had 250,000 readers, but nobody paid us a dime. Our advertisers did. And I loved it. So I kind of backed into media. And then through that, I got a column in this magazine. You know, the gatekeepers were there. Like, I came in and they liked me, and they were gatekeepers. And they're like, we're going to give you a column in this prestigious magazine. And I was writing this computer column, and it was great. And then 2 years later, the internet came out. And anybody with a keyboard could write a computer column, and many of them did. So I got disrupted, but I loved it because it was so much fun. I ended up running internet web businesses. We started a television network in 1997 called ZDTV, became Tech TV. It was the first one focused on technology and geek stuff and all that. And I helped launch that and had a show on that. And so having learned, we actually did a bunch of online, what we called radio at PC Week in the late 90s as well. We were talking about that earlier. So having done television and web and print, in the 2000s, I was running PC Magazine as editor-in-chief, and we realized that the things we were doing at Tech TV, which at that point didn't exist anymore, we could do online. We could create shows and send them out via the internet and reach audiences, and we didn't need all that infrastructure of a television network and satellite dishes and technology, and we had deals with cable operators, and so we started doing that. And that started to go really well. And then as online video really started taking off, I hooked up with a couple of folks that I'd worked with at Tech TV at this cable network who had started an online video network. It was called Revision 3. And they said, hey, you want to come run it? We were raising some money from venture capital. I think we're going to be able to make this thing go. And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? Sounds like fun. Just like I said, yeah, sure, why not? I'll leave this lucrative world of consulting and go work for a magazine. And ended up built this company, Revision 3. 5 years, we were one of the top early networks on YouTube and other places and sold that to Discovery Channel. So went to the Discovery Channel for a couple years. Left there after a little while. And when I was in the early days of Revision 3, that's when VidCon started. So when I heard about VidCon, I was like, oh, this is great. We got to come do this. We got to be there. And actually, Hank was nice enough to have me speak that first year and as the CEO of Revision 3. And through that, I spoke at every VidCon. When I was at Discovery, we actually sponsored VidCon, and I brought a big 60-foot mechanical shark because it was Shark Week, and we were promoting it to the VidCon audience. Then when I left Discovery, I started talking to Hank, and VidCon is three shows in one. It's a festival, which is basically Comic-Con for online video fans. It's a conference, which is, we have a whole, what we call a creator track, where anybody wants to create online video, learn how to be the next Liza Koshy or even Kim Kardashian, will teach you the tools of the trade and the secrets. And then we're a summit as well, which is an industry thing, which is all about, it's a business conference. You come to learn how you make money with online video. So I said to Hank, and this is in 2014, I said, hey, I could come and have some fun with that and really build it into something really big and really like the biggest conference summit in the online video space. Like, yeah, sure. And I wasn't doing anything else because I couldn't go back and work in another media company because I had a non-compete. And so I spent a couple years doing that as a, you know, as a contractor. And then about a year ago, Hank said, hey, we launched internationally. We're really starting to, you know, kick into high gear. The realization of my dream of democratizing the creative economy around the world. I need someone to come run this thing that I built. And it's like, I'm starting to hear from companies that might want to buy us. And, you know, we need money to do what we want to do because Hank and John built it all themselves. No debt, no investment. So a year ago, I went from running the industry tracks to being the CEO of the company. And it's been a year. It's been great. We've done a lot of great stuff. And now we're part of this big media conglomerate. And we're continuing with just to deliver on that promise, which is great.
One of the things that I've noticed in, as I looked at online video creators, and you talked about democratization, is that there is a difference between mainstream TV in the sense of people of color, women, LGBT people that are on. Is that an accurate perception of what's happening on online?
Yeah, I think when you look at online video, because as I talked about early on, like Liza Koshy started at zero, and she built an audience that one by one, two by two, and an audience that in many ways reflects the people there. So the makeup of our country is it's a smorgasbord, right? It's all different types. And because there are no gatekeepers, we had creators of all different types who were able to build audiences around themselves. So the universe of creators online who built themselves up and very community-driven looks like the universe of people that watch it. And it is a very diverse universe. And the creators mirror the diversity of their audiences. Now, I've been in traditional television, but it's on the geek side, right? So, and the gatekeepers there, I don't know if this is the way it happens, but in many ways, those gatekeepers historically have been white males. And there may have been a bias towards bringing in people that look like them. So, but that's changing. I mean, it's changing across right. traditional media
everywhere. But it seems like
everywhere.
It's changing faster in online. I mean, you know, as you look around at the potpourri, the sort of the rainbow of performers, it does look more like a real community as opposed to people handpicked to be in a specific profile.
Exactly, and the beauty of it is that it inspires that audience to say, they're doing it, I can too.
So that brings up a really good point. How do aspiring content providers get involved? What do they do? What's your advice?
So if you're a creator and you want to build your audience, a couple different things. One, find the places, the online video networks that are emerging. So you can go to YouTube, and you should, but YouTube is a busy place. There's a lot of creators there. There's a lot of people vying for your attention. There are ways that you can build audiences there, but it's harder. There are emerging, like huge emerging places where video is coming out where it's a little bit more of a greenfield. So LinkedIn, for example. Now, not everybody is going to be business oriented and, you know, make sense for LinkedIn. A year ago, just about a year ago, LinkedIn video launched. Now, LinkedIn's been around forever. Not forever, but, you know, a long time in internet history. But video's new. And so a year ago, a number of people started creating video on internet and on LinkedIn. And they're LinkedIn stars who probably would never even make it on YouTube. You know, we saw the same thing happen with Instagram, and Instagram TV is pretty much brand new. Maybe there's stuff you can do on Instagram TV. One of the newer ones that's coming out, and I don't know what it's going to look like or what's going to be the thing that works on their platform, but Pinterest. So a buddy of mine is running creator products at Pinterest, and video is really high up in what they want to do. He spoke at VidCon this year. And so we will see Pinterest build video and build video communities and build creators through video in ways that LinkedIn, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram aren't doing. So look for those new communities and figure out how to fit in. The other thing just to keep in mind is each of these platforms, this is Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, YouTube, whatever, they're not monolithic. It's not like in television where I'm going to put my show out on MTV and then it's going to go to Netflix and then it's going to go to like the WB channel on, you know, 81 or whatever.
8:30 on Wednesday night.
Right, but the thing is that you can take that show and put it on all those different platforms without changing it, right? when you do something for YouTube, you can't just stick that thing on Facebook and expect it to be popular. Each one of these platforms has its own set of formats or its own set of types of content that works. Now, YouTube's great for vlogging and prank videos and music and things like that. But there's a service called Twitch from Amazon, which if you're not a gamer, you probably don't know. But Twitch is great for game streaming. People watch gamers play video games for hours. Fortnite. You want to go watch people play Fortnite? Go to Twitch. They own that. Facebook kind of owns this sort of videos that are short and surreptitious. They're trying to be more like television. Instagram, the videos that they're doing on Instagram TV are vertical. They're not 16 by 9 wide. They're 9 by 16 tall. That's an entirely different format. So find out the formats that work on those platforms and create video for those. The last thing is find creators that are successful on those platforms that do things similar to what you want to do, build a connection with them, and hopefully you can collaborate with them sometime.
So all of this is pretty new and changing and evolving. So what does the future for a consumer look like? How do they, you know, make sure that they're connected to all of this and, are aware of what's happening?
What we're seeing is this explosion of choice. And so when there are so many options that are out there, that's where curators come in. Now think about Spotify, right? If you use Spotify, and many, many people do, the playlists are amazing. The discovery is amazing. The way that they curate music, so if you like this type of music, you can get exposed to other things like it, is awesome. Pandora did that as well and still does. So find the people that you like, the creators that you like, the type of content that you like. And chances are there are going to be a whole bunch of creators that do things like that. But then follow their recommendations. Because if you're a geeky sort of person into science and history and stuff like that, and you start watching Hank and John Green, which you should, Vlogbrothers, SciShow, Crash Course, they're going to recommend other people. They'll have guests on their YouTube channel. They'll have recommended people that they like. Start following them. And so, you know, YouTube does a good job with recommendations. Watch their recommended videos. Facebook also does a reasonably good job of putting new stuff in front of you, as do the other services. So, you know, the onus is on you. You're not just going to sit down and plop yourself in front of CBS and watch all night. CBS is a curator too, right? They curated their primetime lineup for you. MTV and Nickelodeon, all those guys are doing the same thing. But you can do that, but go hunt out, because it's going to be much better for you, and you'll be much more satisfied by that time you spend in front of our glowing rectangles if you're actively involved in finding the things that appeal to you.
Or you can just ask Alexa or Watson what to do.
Yeah, you can do that too.
What's the future look like for you?
I love the creative economy. I love creators. Remember what I was talking about earlier, where I got a column in a computer magazine in the early 90s, and I was like, I reached the pinnacle of my life, and I don't think it was even 30. And then all of a sudden, 2 years later, everybody could do it. And to me, that wasn't a disaster. That was amazing. And so whatever I do, it will be to continue to foster the sense of, if you're, everybody is creative, everybody is a creator. The power of the internet allows people to be a creator, to be creative in any way they want, and to find an audience. And for the ones who put the time in and the effort and are talented, they can build a life. They can get paid. They can buy a house. They can get married. They can have babies if they want. They can travel the world if they want. And the idea that through being creative and being a creator, you don't need those gatekeepers to realize your dreams. Whatever I do, I'm going to continue to foster that, because to me, that's one of the most powerful movements of our time.
Jim, it's always great talking to you and catching up with you. Hope to see you again soon.
Absolutely. I can't wait. It's great chatting with you too.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced by Autumn Barnes and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time to Can Do, when our guest will be Christina Henderson, Executive Director of the Montana High Tech Alliance. Once again, I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity. Production support for this Can Do podcast is made possible in part by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Support for this Montana Public Radio podcast comes from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.